huge amounts of economic migration at the same time, because the public, apart from anything else, mix these two things up. I think that we should remain somewhere where people can come when they're fleeing totalitarianism. I think we should also encourage them, by the way, after those regimes fall, to take part in the rebuilding of their own countries. That's something we haven't encouraged at all. And it's very strange, because it means, apart from anything else, there's a sort of brain drain from certain countries.
But they often want to go home if the country has changed.
Absolutely, then. Absolutely. And I think there's nothing wrong with encouraging that.
But not insisting.
I'd be careful on insisting.
Tell me about the Henry Jackson Society. Who was he?
He was a Democrat. And he was part of a tradition in America, which I think sadly is going there, and which may be going here, of people who realise that there are some issues that are way beyond party politics.
So you're suspicious of the political classes, qua political classes?
Yes, deeply. I understand that you have to collect views broadly around some kind of consensus, but the way in which our political structure is set up to basically quash outside opinion, and within its own structures to stop people speaking freely. Because after all, we always complain that everyone is too monotone in our politics, and then whenever anyone says anything else, they're said to have created a gaffe. I want more gaffes.
Matthew Paris has written of you, Douglas Murray writes so well that when he's wrong, it's dangerous. How often do you confess to being wrong, Douglas?
Well, I like to think I can, and I do. I have admitted I've been wrong on a number of occasions.
Such as?
There are, for instance, actually, when I reversed my feelings on religion, I admitted some things I'd been wrong about, and I think I've reversed some of that, although it doesn't mean I've gone back to the place I started necessarily. But I like to think as well, if I get a fact wrong or say something wrong, that I can say so.
I've remarked on your youth, Douglas. I hope you'll excuse that. But it does mean that you've got a long life ahead of you. So what do you think you will live to see? What prospects do you see in the decades ahead for yourself and for society?
I hope that some of the things I say and have said in recent years continue to become a bit more mainstream. I'm sure that other issues will open up. I suppose what I do care about is conserving the things that are valuable and good in our culture. And I think one of the things when I look forward is that there will probably be a further pulling apart of sections of our society. I can't help thinking, I notice it the more I look around now, that the period of thinking that there was going to be a great melting pot has not really happened. It didn't happen in America, actually, although integration occurs. What I do think is that there will be some kind of restatement of ourselves and our values and our heritage, which will allow people once more, instead of thinking of it as somehow crass or naff or indeed stupid or bigoted to talk about your cherishing of the culture which you come from, may realise that this is actually a decent position and a perfectly viable position. I do worry about it, everybody does, that restating of your values and your culture may go in the wrong direction. I see that happening in certain European countries at the moment. I've seen it several times, actually. I simply think that there is an opportunity to do that restating in an open, liberal-minded, tolerant way, which is, as I say, tolerant of difference, but not infinitely so, and something which is grateful rather than proud.
Douglas Murray, thank you.
Joan Bakewell's guest in Belief was Douglas Murray. You can hear that programme and the others in the series by going to the BBC iPlayer. The producer in Salford is Claire Jaquis.
BBC Radio 3 revisits January 1914. A continent alive with culture. Concert halls, cafes, theatres and opera houses. Conductors and soloists touring the globe across European borders. 7 months later, this world would end. Radio 3 steps into the cultural ferment of Europe at the outset of 1914. Each day throughout next week, we focus on a different city. Music on the Brink. Starting each day in breakfast, weekday mornings from 6:30 on BBC Radio 3.
This is BBC Radio 3. We're broadcasting between 90 and 93 FM on digital radio and also in high-definition sound online. And we're going back in history now, not quite to 1914, just to 2013. It's time for another highlight from last year's BBC prom season. And this late prom was introduced by Catherine Bott.
Welcome to the Royal Albert Hall. Gathered behind me on stage are the Monteverdi Choir and the English Baroque soloists. And last time we were all here was on a freezing Easter Monday for a Bach marathon, which ended with a heartening performance of the Mass in B minor. Now, on a sultry August evening, we're going to hear two oratorios by Bach, which are undeservedly much less well-known than the Mass in B minor. And this late-night prom begins with a work that's been described as a mix of the exultant, the contemplative, and the highly wrought. Astonishingly, only excerpts have been heard at the proms before, and those not since the 1950s. John Elliott Gardiner is a man with a lot of proms firsts to his name. Now, please welcome him as he comes on to conduct the Monteverdi Choir and the English Baroque soloists in the first complete proms performance of Bach's Easter Oratorio.
Thank you. act. Stein, der solche zugedämmt. Wo aber wird mein Heiland sein?
Er ist vom Tode auferweckt. Wir trafen einen Engel an, der hat uns solches Gut getan.
Hier seh ich mit Vergnügen das Schweißbuch abgewickelt.
Das wird mich dort erfrischen und die Zellen meiner Pein von den Wangen tröstlich wischen. Ja, das wird mich dort erfrischen und die Zellen meiner Pein von den Wangen tröstlich wischen und die Zellen meiner Pein, die Zellen meiner Pein von den Wangen tröstlich wischen, von den Wangen tröstlich.
der Freud, dass unser Jesus wieder lebt und unser Herz so erst in Traurigkeit zerflossen und geschwebt, vergisst den Schmerz und sinnt auf Freudenlieder, denn unser Heiland lebet wieder.
Let joy be unconfined, a positively beatific smile from Sir John Eliot Gardiner at the end of Bach's Easter Oratorio, which was probably first heard complete in Leipzig on Easter Day 1735, and was definitely first heard complete at the BBC Proms just now. John Eliot Gardiner conducted the Monteverdi Choir and the English Baroque soloists Lieder Maya Homburger, with soprano Hannah Morrison, mezzo-soprano Meg Bregel, tenor Nicholas Mulroy and bass Peter Harvey. And it's a very egalitarian evening because there are two leaders sharing the job. Kati Debreceni, who was sitting desk partnering Maya in that piece, will lead the Ascension Oratorio in a few minutes. And all the solo singers are standing with the choir and joining in very heartily. special bow for Michael Niesemann, the principal oboist, and just before that for flautist Rachel Beckett, who also was joined by Christine Garrett on a rather plangent recorder duet. Recorder often used in Baroque music to symbolise the departed spirit, and indeed that's never more appropriate than at the Easter Oratorio. Well, by 1735, when that piece was first heard, the Easter Oratorio already had quite a history, going back 10 years. The seeds of it were first planted in birthday cantatas for prominent members of the local nobility. A task that, well, it went with the job for an 18th century composer, didn't it? But Bach also used some of the material in his church cantata for Easter Day 1725, with a story of the discovery of Christ's empty tomb elaborated on by four soloists portraying Mary, mother of James, Mary Magdalene, Peter and John. It wasn't until 1735 that Bach revisited the cantata, took out the characters' names and made significant changes to the orchestral and choral writing. He'd composed five cycles of cantatas for the church year in the previous decade, and now he was going to enjoy himself making new music from old. The two oratorios we're hearing tonight are both much less substantial than the better-known Christmas oratorio, in length anyway, but Bach only used the word oratorio to describe these three works, and they all have their roots firmly planted in the church cantata tradition. In a moment, I'm going to ask John Elliott Gardiner himself about the use of the word oratorio, and in fact, we're going on stage now. There will be a proper chance to tune in just a moment, but we're going to hear from John Elliott Gardiner first. We've just heard the Easter Oratorio, absolutely gorgeous, and in a minute, the Ascension Oratorio. I've never sung either of them. Why are they so shamefully neglected, these pieces?
Well, your musical education is always a bit suspect, Kate, you know. We've got to... No, she's a fantastically good singer, actually.
You're
absolutely right. They are neglected, and I don't know why, because it is a fantastic piece that Bach sort of acts like a grandmaster of chess because he anticipates so many moves ahead, and he can see all sorts of different destinations for his music. I mean, that piece started off as a pastoral secular piece, totally inappropriate for Easter. Then it became another secular piece, then it became an Easter cantata, not very successfully. And then he really, really got into it when he revised it as an oratorio.
Well, I've already promised listeners at home that I'm going to ask you why he called these three pieces oratorios. I mean, are they not just souped-up cantatas?
Yeah, well, they are souped-up cantatas, but they do have one distinguishing quality, which is that they have a narration, not so much in the one we just heard, but much more in the one you're about to hear, where the tenor acts as an evangelist, just as he does in the Christmas oratorio. So he's actually enunciating biblical words, the narrative. The one we've just heard, the characters are much more etiolated, much more kind of in the background, as it were. They're not literally John, Peter, and Mary, and Mary.
I heard a few. I know my education is lacking,
suspect.
as you have pointed out, but even I spotted a few echoes or pre-echoes of other pieces by Bach, particularly in the orchestral writing. Yeah. And I know that we're going to have a big pre-echo of the Agnus Dei from the B minor Mass.
Indeed.
Coming up.
But there's a trap there too, because there's a missing piece, which, you know, sadly we don't have. It's the origin of the Agnus Dei and of this Ach bleibe doch, which stands as a sort of grandfather to these two siblings. And again, it's just extraordinary how Bach finds a new destination for his music, but also a new expressive voice and a new type of affect that touches us so deeply.
Last question. We last met, you and I, on this stage.
We did.
On a freezing cold Easter Monday, April Fool's Day.
It was.
Is your relationship with Bach still as passionate as it was then?
What? And with you? Why wouldn't it be?
I don't know. I'm just having my Jeremy Paxman moment.
Oh, are you having your Paxman moment? Look, there's certain composers that are non-negotiable, and he's one. And he really is. And there's always something new to discover. There's always some joy to uncover, to relish, to just, you know, bathe in. It's just such fantastic music.
Well, I don't know how many people in the hall tonight were here on Easter Monday, but I was sitting very quietly just there, and joining in quite quietly and discreetly at that glorious moment when you taught us all how to sing the chorale.
But it wasn't,
in
it was Howard. Howard did the job. He did the job.
Well, yes, Howard did that, but you came on and were magisterial afterwards.
Well, he did the work.
It was a great, great moment, but
yeah,
no community singing tonight.
Well, the one chorale we're going to sing tonight is incredibly quiet, so maybe it might be a good idea if you have to hum, just hum very, very softly. But I mean, I don't even allow the orchestra to play in it, except just one flute and one cello. That's all, the bass, that's all.
Well, talking of the orchestra, we interrupted their brief moment of tuning. The choir would probably like to clear its collective throat as well. So let's let them do that. Thank you very much, John
Thank
Elliott.
Thank you, Kate.
And when they have done that, I have briefly to introduce the Ascension Oratorio.
Can I push you off just a moment?
Two sentences. Yes, please.
Thank you. See you in a moment.
Now everybody is ready, including all of you. John Elliott Gardiner first conducted the Ascension Oratorio at the Proms back in 1971. It's a favorite of his, and he says, it's full of music that makes you want to get up and dance. It's Bach at his absolute best. Please welcome him back. Thank you.
Hob seine Hände auf und segnete seine Jünger. Und es geschah, da sie segnete, schied von ihnen. Ach, thank you.
Aufgehoben zu sehens und fuhr auf gen Himmel. Eine Wolke nahm ihn weg vor ihren Augen, und er sitzet zur rechten Hand Gottes.
Thank you. zwei Männer in weißen Kleidern, welche auch sagten, ihr Männer von Galiläa, was stiehlt ihr und seht den Himmel? Dieser Jesus, der von euch ist aufgenommen, der Ölberg, welcher ist nahe bei Jerusalem und liegt einen Sabbaterweg davon. Und sie kehrten wieder gen Jerusalem mit großer Freude.
Thank you.
Bach's Ascension Oratorio, performed there at the 2013 BBC Proms by the Monteverdi Choir and English Baroque soloists, conducted by John Elliott Gardner. The soloists were soprano Hannah Morrison, mezzo Meg Bradle, the tenor Nicholas Mulroy, and the bass Peter Harvey. And that prom was introduced by Catherine Bott. Well, on Sunday evening, we have two final offerings for you to end our season of highlights from the proms of last year. At 7:30, Joseph Kalea stars in a gargantuan feast of Verdi and Tchaikovsky. And then at 11 o'clock, there's another chance to hear the remarkable vocal group Naturally Seven. That's all on Sunday evening.
BBC Radio 3 revisits January 1914. A continent alive with culture. Concert halls, cafes, theatres and opera houses. Conductors and soloists touring the globe across European borders. 7 months later, this world would end. On BBC Radio 3, Music on the Brink, with as its centrepiece a performance of songs and piano music from composers in Paris on the eve of World War I. Tuesday night at 7:30 on BBC Radio 3.
Thank you.
A bit more Bach. Bozzoni's transcription of Wacht auf, the chorale prelude BWV 645, played by Nikolai Demidenko. Time now on Radio 3 for World on 3 with Lapa Kattari.
Welcome to the first World on 3 of 2014. And after all the excesses, no doubt, over the festive season, tonight's programme is going to be a mix of final holiday weekend sounds. So I thought we'd start with the sounds of rebellion. I don't know if that sums up your Christmas and New Year, but it is actually the sounds of Angola in the late 60s, to be exact, a time when music became the voice of revolution against the colonial power, the Portuguese. Here are Negoyeros de Ritmo with a song called Lemba. Negoyeros de Ritmo and Lemba from Angola's soundtrack Volume 2, a compilation out on Analog Africa dedicated to the short-lived recording industry in Angola that lasted just 10 years from 1969 to 78. But in that time created three recording companies and more than 800 records, mostly singles. The song was written by the band's guitarist, Almerindo Cruz. Almerindo wrote the song to tell his girlfriend that he wasn't married and to trust him in an effort to refute the lies that were being spread about him. She, in fact, met someone else, as did he, and they all lived happily ever after. The album is worth adding to your collection, and I'm going to play another track from it later on in the programme. Hello, I'm Lapa Kotari. On World on Three tonight, we've got the truly dulcet tones of Jamaican lovers rock legend Cornell Campbell, who's joined by Londoners the Soothsayers. I've also got music from some of the names to watch out for this year and new releases from Grammy Award.